Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over 70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's guest is Amy Willens. Amy Willens is a contributing editor for The Nation magazine, professor of English, a literary journalism program, the University of California, Irvine. Amy Willens, it's almost 4 years since Haiti experienced a devastating earthquake, and Amy Willens is here to speak to us about the politics and culture of relief and reconstruction post-earthquake Haiti.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to talk to you about the earthquake, but I want to talk to you a little bit about Haiti and why Haiti is interesting in and of itself rather than just because it had a huge natural disaster. So I've had a long engagement with Haiti. I thought when I first started my career, I thought maybe I was a foreign correspondent, but it turned out that I was just a Haiti correspondent because I was lucky enough to get down to Haiti, which is a tiny island off the Florida coast, by the way, for all of you who might not know. I was lucky enough to get down there as the dictatorship fell in 1986. So it was almost a 30-year-long dictatorship of a father and son, the Duvaliers. And a week after I got there, it fell, and there was a huge popular uprising. And theoretically, democracy had come to this little island. But it was a long time coming, and democracy is still struggling to embed itself in Haiti. And I have been back and forth for all of this. So I've watched this country kind of in fits and starts struggle into modernity in its own particular idiosyncratic way. So I always laugh because I never really intended to write books about this place. Now I've written two. This is my most recent. You'll see it has little wings, as all my books have. Farewell, Fred Voodoo. My first one was called The Rainy Season. And I've lived in the Middle East also, and I worked in Jerusalem as a kind of foreign correspondent, but mostly as a mother when I was there. And in the Middle East, they have this joke about writers who come into Jerusalem and study the Arab-Israeli conflict. And when you first arrive, you want to write a book about it. After a year, you want to write a story about it. And after a decade, you're mute and you have nothing left to say. And in Haiti, it's a similar kind of problem, but I think it's a little more interesting. When you arrive, all you can talk about, and all foreigners do this, is the tap-tap. A tap-tap is a little jitney bus, and in Haiti, they're like traveling works of art. They're so incredible, detailed works by actual artists who design them and paint them and give them names like Thank God and Thank You, Jesus. They're very religious. They have balloons and the kinds of tubes you use when you swim in a pool, like swans and ducks, and they're just amazing things. So you just write about them all the time. Then after a year, you don't even see them anymore. They're just normal. It's like a yellow cab in New York City. It's hardly visible. And after a decade, you're not mute exactly, but maybe it's because of Haiti's French traditions and French literary criticism and stuff like that. You suddenly decide you want to write a treatise, not about Haiti, but about the tap-tap. You want to explain the whole world in terms of this one thing that for a decade you didn't even see. Now that seems to explain the whole place. So that's what, and I always tell my students in literary journalism that what happens when you're really working well on a story is you begin to be like a paranoid schizophrenic. Everything reminds you of that story. You can't walk down a street without thinking of the place or the people you're writing about. And you become like a crazy person to your friends. So they'll say hi, and you'll say, oh, in Haiti, you know how we say hi? It gets to be that craziness. So I was in North Carolina Yes, we're just readjusting the technology. Sorry. That's all right. I love to be fixed.
Okay.
Thanks. That's a lot of technology going on here. Can you guys hear me now? Good. So last week I was at Duke in North Carolina doing some work with a bunch of Haiti experts there. And they have something called the Haiti Memory Project. And I was thinking that I myself am the living Haiti Memory Project. I've been going back and forth so long. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about Haiti's long, fascinating history. So Haiti was a slave colony of the French. The Spanish were there also, the English were there also, but the French were the dominant colonial power in Haiti. And in 1791, incredibly, the slave population rebelled against their French masters, and they were successful. In 1804, Haiti declared its independence from France. So it was the first successful slave revolt and the only successful slave revolution in the history of mankind. So that made it kind of special. And it's important to remember that it was 1804. So the great power to the north was the United States, which still had slaves, still was based in part on a slave economy. So Haiti was turned into, naturally, a pariah nation. Who wanted to have free black people on an island so close to a country where black people were still considered slaves? So the Americans embargoed it and wouldn't trade with it, and they tried to cut off trade with Haiti. And it was fairly successful. And that was, that, which I now think, a very brave, very incredible, colorful revolution against Napoleon. I now think of it as a very premature revolution. In other words, the Haitians were certainly ready to be free, as any slave population is probably ready at any minute to be free. But the world was not ready for a successful slave revolution. And so I think that the Haitians have suffered a lot because of that initial event in Haitian history. And Frederick Douglass said in the late 1880s at the World's Fair in Chicago, he said, "The world has never forgiven Haiti for being black." So I think that that's how the nation's identity has been formed. It's how Haitians think of themselves in relation to the rest of the world as people who've been oppressed and turned into pariahs because of their history. I just want to add that in 1915, the United States, sensing a lot of trouble for American interests in Haiti, business interests, came into Haiti and occupied the country. So, and they stayed there for till, I think it was 19 years, U.S. military occupation of Haiti. And then they were sort of overthrown by another grassroots, like freedom fighters is what we would have called them in the 1970s. Who kicked them out of the country, and the Americans decided to go. So I'm obsessed with all this lost past in Haiti. And I wanted to talk a little bit before I get to the earthquake about the little Haitian chair. So there is a chair in Haiti that when I was first coming in the 1980s was made by the peasants. And that's what they call them in Haiti. On your national identification, it actually still says peasant. And on the city, if you come from the city, it says citoyen. From the city in French. So there's this little chair, and it's just the cutest chair that the Haitian peasants make out of palm and wood. And it's chubby, and it's very uncomfortable. It's like the most uncomfortable chair you've ever sat in. And for my first book, I actually sat in one of those chairs, and everybody used to sit in them. They were everywhere. They were in all the fancy restaurants. You would sit in these uncomfortable chairs. In your office, you would sit in them. All the peasants would sit in them when they had a chair. It was considered quite an item for a farming family to have. But it was the national chair. And so I wrote about, from this chair, I wrote about U.S. subsidized rice that was destroying the Haitian rice market. I wrote about the beginnings of Haiti joining the global community. And I wrote about the beginnings of the infiltration of Haiti's economy by the global economy. And so there was this rice that was coming in and causing farmers to have to abandon their farms in the countryside because they could no longer compete in the market against our excess rice that was coming in under humanitarian terms. So little did I know while I was writing about this initial penetration of Haiti by the global market that my chair that I was sitting on was also in danger from globalization. So now in Haiti, there's a new little chair. And you all would recognize the new little chair. The Haitian chair would be quite an alien being to you. But the new little chair in Haiti is the white or green plastic mold chair that we've all sat in everybody's backyard, on everybody's front porch. You know it well. It stacks. It's a very convenient chair. So this chair is made in Huangyang, China, at the plastic molds factory, one of the plastic molds factory there. And on the Huangyang website, it says that the city itself is famous as Plastic Mold Town. So we all now know that this chair is from China. It's come in, and it's replaced the Haitian chair. Now, I have to say one thing about this chair. It's pretty comfortable, right? We all know that. And it's so convenient. In the old days, if you were an artisan or a craftsman who made the Haitian chair, you would want to carry it into the market to sell it. Well, to carry the Haitian chair through the market, you'd have like six of them. You'd look like a tinker toy. I don't know if you guys remember those wooden toys with spokes. It was very hard to negotiate the transport of these chairs. But with the Chinese chair, of course, you carry it like this. You can carry 20. A Haitian can carry 20 in one hand through the market easily. So they're transportable, stackable, comfortable, and they're replacing the Haitian chair. So I was very sad about this, right? I love the Haitian chair. It spoke to me of old Haiti. Haitians, however, not so sad. They like the new chair. The new chair is cheaper than the old chair. The new chair is more comfortable than the old chair. The new chair is more transportable. So this, to me, is part of the problem with outsiders and Haiti. When you're an outsider, you have a nostalgia for certain artifacts of the country that you come into that you want to preserve while that country wants to go on being a real place. So the Haitian chair will probably be lost. The old jars that Haitian women used to carry on their heads and the old baskets woven of palm will probably be lost. And what are they being replaced with? Plastic bags. Now, again, in the old days, the postcard from Haiti was a lady with a woven basket on her head carrying stuff to market. Now, if you want to take that picture and put it on a postcard, she's going to have a plastic garbage bag on her head. It's just not as lovely for us. For her, it's very convenient. You know, it ties, it molds to her head so it's not as hard to carry. It's light, but for us, it kind of looks like a garbage bag on your head. Haitian traditional clothing. So when I first got there, ladies in the countryside wore, I mean, stuff that we would consider in the U.S. to be antebellum slave plantation clothing. Homemade, white dresses with blue denim aprons. I have a problem with technology. With blue denim aprons and like zigzagging decoration on it. Now they wear jeans and t-shirts. So all that stuff that I loved is lost. And they don't love the old stuff. They love the new stuff. They want the jeans. The girls in town want tight jeans and nice t-shirts that are bought secondhand from us. And in one of life's little global ironies, sometimes those t-shirts may have been made in Haiti. Because now there are new offshore factories in Haiti since the earthquake run by South Korean companies where Haitians are putting t-shirts together for Walmart and Target. So what happens in the global market, the Haitians make the t-shirts for less money per day than each individual t-shirt is sold for to you at Walmart or Target. Then you wear the t-shirt for like a year, and then it's like faded and has a spot on it. You don't like it anymore. You give it to Goodwill. Goodwill bundles it up with a million other t-shirts and sends it back to Haiti. And then they get sold in the Haitian market for little enough money so the Haitians can buy them. So that is one of the ways in which the global market is just so ironic it makes your head spin. And yet, of course, I hate those factories, and I think they're bad for Haitians. So I went up to the factory in Haiti where some of these are made, and I was interviewing people who work down by the Citadel. The Citadel is this fabulous castle on top of a mountain that was built by one of the heroes of the Haitian Revolution, built with a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and death by former Haitian slaves. And the people who live in the area of the Citadel, incredibly to us in America, here we are in Utah after all, they are the same families as the people who lived there at the time that this castle was built. So they're the same families living on the same properties as the slaves from those days. And I talked to them, and I said, would you want your daughter to go work in this factory making T-shirts? Yes, if only we knew someone at the factory, if only we could get that job, we would love to have that job. So again, it was something that I was disdaining as an outsider, as not befitting of the dignity of the Haitian people, that the Haitian people actually wanted. So outsiders was my next subject for my book. So my first book about Haiti was to explain Haitians to us. My second book about Haiti, Farewell Fred Voodoo, is to explain us and what we're doing. What is our project in Haiti? Because after the earthquake, one of the things I noticed was these flights that I would take into Haiti. I used to go from New York. So I would take a flight into Haiti. It would be me and a lot of Haitians who were taking their second flight. They had come out of Haiti, and now they were going back. That was their second flight in their whole lives. They would go back into Haiti. So I was like the only white person on these flights. Now, after the earthquake, it was me and a lot of missionaries and a lot of non-governmental organization workers and State Department people. I call them white flights. So there were all these flights into the country filled with white people who wanted to do good and help out. And not obviously not just white people. There were a lot of Haitian diaspora people, people who'd fled Haiti to make lives for themselves in the U.S. And there were, of course, people of all colors, because America is a place of all colors, people of all colors from France. But basically, at the very least, it was an outsider community. And I remember so well thinking, what is going to become of these people when they get to Haiti? There was one group of kids, they were on a mission after the earthquake to help out in Haiti. And they were sitting at the airport in Miami, this was, and they all had pink T-shirts on, and they all had their little backpacks on, and they were kids. They were like, you know, 16 and 17. And when I got home, I looked up their organization on its website, and the motto for this program that these kids were on was, have an awesome adventure in Haiti. And I had been in the earthquake already, so I knew that whether the kids were going to have an awesome adventure or not, it was not an awesome adventure at that moment for the Haitians. So when I first went back into the earthquake, which is how I think of it, and an earthquake like that is really an all-involving phenomenon. I don't know if you guys have ever been in an earthquake. I wasn't in the earthquake itself. I came in like about a week and a half after. There were still aftershocks that felt like a nuclear weapon was hitting the island. But the effects of the earthquake itself, you were walking over rubble with bodies underneath it. The stench was horrible. On the walls, instead of graffiti written, the usual political graffiti, was written things like, farewell Louise, where she had died, you know, by her husband. I met a guy who was standing outside of the office building that had fallen on his wife, and he wanted to get her out, but more important, she always kept all of their documents with her for safekeeping at her office so they wouldn't be vulnerable to thievery at home. And now he didn't have his identity, he didn't have his passport, he had nothing, and I don't think he ever could have gotten it out of that wreckage from what I saw. So I saw that, and everybody saw it. I don't know if you guys were really aware of it, but it was all over television, of course, and it was very dramatic video footage. So there's a saying among journalists that perhaps would make some people want to be a journalist and not make others want to be a journalist, but it's famous from the Vietnam War. Anybody here been raped and speaks English? That's the journalist's cry in a foreign country, because you want to get them on tape so that you can show them at home. But if they only speak Khmer, it's not going to really work. So in Haiti, I always say, anyone here been raped and can be added to our statistics for fundraising purposes? You know, because that's what happened a lot after this earthquake was, it was a great opportunity, and that was noted. And people said, this is a great opportunity for Haitians, for Haiti. Haitians didn't think so. They thought it was a giant wreck of their capital city. And, you know, up to 300,000 people may have died in this earthquake. So they didn't really see it as an opportunity so much as a funeral, a national funeral. But outsiders thought it was a great opportunity for Haiti because, outsiders reasoned, that country's a wreck, that country's poor, the buildings were not very good anyway, a lot of people died, well, it's overpopulated. Now we can rebuild it nicely the way we think things should be built, and maybe it will be better off. It's a great opportunity. But what it was really a great opportunity for was non-governmental organizations, charitable groups, missionaries who could really have an astounding experience, if not an awesome adventure there, and all sorts of other people who were coming in, contractors, architects. It was an incredible fiesta, and that's why my planes were filled with these people. It was a business, and it is a business now. I wanted to describe some of the unintended consequences of this kind of situation. And I think it happens all over the world, but in Haiti, Haiti is uniquely situated a little too close to the United States. So it was very available for everybody to come down there and take videos and also get involved. You could get involved, and then when it became too much, you could go to Miami for drinks with your friends and then fly back into the earthquake. You know, you could take a mental health break. Whereas if it were in some remote place far in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, it wouldn't have been so frequented. So that's good and bad, right? And there were a lot of unintended consequences of Haiti's earthquake help. One of the ones I like to talk about is when I was there about 2 months before my book was published, 3 years after the earthquake, there were still earthquake camps. They were like refugee camps of people who were rendered homeless by the earthquake. So I would go into these littler camps. The big camps had been depopulated, the ones that were really becoming an embarrassment. You shouldn't have an earthquake camp 3 years after the earthquake. So these non-governmental organizations would hand out money, $500 to each family, and would find housing either in housing that was already present or in new temporary housing. Not very great housing, but some place to live for the people who are living in really unappealing, horrible, probably unhealthy camps. And those people would leave with their $500, and either they would go to the new housing or they would go to their mother's house and save the $500. Nobody really knows where everybody ended up, but they would leave, and those camps were depopulated. But that left a lot of little, more hidden camps still populated. And I went to one at the end of 2012. It was called the St. Anne Camp because it was in a square outside the Church of St. Anne, which was no longer there because it fell down in the earthquake. But it was still called St. Anne Camp. So I went in and I talked to people there, and they were just living in the worst conditions. I saw an old man. He was living under a tent, but the tent was just came up this high above the floor, and he had a mattress. That was it. And his family had died in the earthquake. There was no one to help him. There were people living in, as if it were an apartment building, a jungle gym, a children's playground thing. You know, one family at the bottom, one with the captain's wheel at the top, one under the little bridge with tarps. It was very horrible, and it was about 12,000 people total, including lots of children. So that camp was, they wouldn't leave. And I kept thinking, people, just leave. You don't have to stay here. Go find somewhere else to live. You can do it. You're smart. You're Haitians. You'll know how to do it. You'll figure it out. But they didn't want to leave because they had heard about the $500. And they were darned if they were going to leave before that $500 came to them, too. They thought, well, we've been living in a camp for 3 years. What makes us any less worthy of that $500 gift than the other people in the other camps? So they were kind of bound and determined to stay there, and no one was giving them the $500 because no one cared if they stayed. They weren't very visible. Meanwhile, $7 million had been given by the World Bank and the Clinton Bush Foundation in Haiti, both post-earthquake funds, to build something called the Royal Oasis Hotel. It was a $7 billion construction loan. And I went to the Royal Oasis Hotel the day that I had visited the St. Anne camp. It was its grand opening, and people were coming in fancy dress for the grand opening. I went into the Royal Oasis Hotel, which is sort of nice, not that nice. It's a glorified Days Inn, in my opinion. And I went up in the elevator with a business friend of mine, a Haitian. We were stuck in the elevator. So it wasn't working, but it had been had $7 million given to it by the outside earthquake helping community. But it was had nothing to do with the earthquake. It was just a luxury hotel. So I wondered, I thought to myself, well, why? And so it was explained to me, well, this will give Haitians jobs. And I thought, well, why not do it the other way? Why not have the people from the World Bank and the Clinton Bush Fund do the jobs at that
place, and then we could have the Haitians from the St. Anne camp come stay there. And we could put each family into its own luxury room, presidential suite, probably they could take 4 or 5 families, and then the money would be being spent on earthquake victims. So there were a lot of unintended consequences. In the end, the St. Anne camp was depopulated by the Haitian police, who came in and simply kicked them out. They offered them some bread instead of the $500. So this was like, that's just one of the many unintended consequences of helping in Haiti after the earthquake. I learned a lot about various little catchphrases that they have for the helping community that goes around the world helping in natural disasters and other situations. It's called the crisis caravan, and it goes from the tsunami to the earthquake to the tsunami to the next earthquake to the nuclear meltdown. And these are all people whose really their careers are in crisis management and crisis help. There's the compassion economy. That's the weird sort of artificial economy that springs up when people come in with money into economies where there's a crisis, a catastrophe, and also a sort of third world economic situation in the first place. They're mobile sovereigns. It's one of my favorite words that I learned, which means the people who go out in their nice four-wheel drive air-conditioned cars into situations of dire poverty to help out and distribute funds and do projects. Those are the little mobile sovereigns. They're usually Americans with an anthropology degree. Charity anxiety, that's something I experience. Probably everybody here has experienced, but this is on a grand scale. It's like, if I give them money, what will they do with it? So, like, if you give a guy in the street who asks you for money, what will he do with it? Will he spend it on drugs? Will he spend it on alcohol? Or will he spend it on his family? Charity anxiety and sympathy fatigue. That's when you just get bored of the whole darn situation and you just don't want to deal with it anymore. But the biggest lesson I learned there was this lesson. You know the expression, to give is better than to receive? Well, okay, maybe you all believe that, but I'm kind of cynical, and I always thought it was better to receive. I like presents. Does anyone here not like presents? I really like getting presents. I could get presents every day and be a very happy person and never give one out, okay? And I would still be happy because I like to get. I like to receive. But it turns out in the end that the famous saying is true, to give is better than to receive. In Haiti, I noticed that to give was better to receive because if you gave in post-quake Haiti, you lived in a very nice, new, gated community while you handed out your largesse to help the victims of the earthquake. You had huge amounts of security, not that there was ever any unrest in Haiti after the earthquake, but there was fear of unrest. You got to drive in Nissan patrols, which are these gigantic, what we call them embassy cars in Haiti, where the U.S. kind of cars the U.S. embassy personnel use. You got to go, after you helped work with the poor every day, you got to go to bars and dinners in Pichonville, which is the town just up the hill from where the earthquake really struck, where there were just, you know, there's a fabulous nightlife. There's a jazz festival every year in Haiti. There's a movie festival every year in Haiti. And the giving community, the relief and especially the reconstruction community, got to really have a nice time after those days. Hard days working with the poor. I used to joke in the old days as a journalist that I wished Haiti were the kind of country where you could be among the people for, you know, the full day, and then at the end you would just drive up to a little mountain resort and have poached salmon and a glass of white wine. But it wasn't that country until after the earthquake. So you've done all these incredible things, and you feel good about yourself. And I have a friend who says, redemption is Haiti's biggest export. And I think that's true. I mean, you look at the movie stars who've gone down, Donna Karan, who's down there, Sean Penn. All these people feel that they've done an incredible thing. And in the case of Sean Penn, I think he did a pretty remarkable job. He became effectively mayor of a 60,000-person town, his earthquake camp, and he did finally depopulate it. So he did some amazing things. But then I hear things like, well, gosh, today we saved 16 children. And I was talking to the kids in North Carolina about that. They had been in Haiti, and they were living with some missionaries. And the kids I was talking to were just students. They weren't missionaries. And the missionary kids would come back and say, we saved 16 children. And my students that I was talking to would say, well, in what way? And they had brought them to Jesus. And then the job was over, and then they went on to the next orphanage and brought another 16 children and saved them. So, you know, it depends how you structure your mission, what good you're really going to do for the people whom you're helping. And I always thought that it was interesting to hear Haitians talk about the outsiders who were there. You would think of yourself as, you know, a do-gooder, helping out, offering services. You had all this know-how. And that's the outsider identity there. Good person, almost a saint for doing this. And the Haitians thought of you as in summer camp, building your resume, having a fun internship, driving in fancy cars while they were still effectively living in these camps. So who was doing whom good? And I felt often that the Haitians were just a statistic for fundraising and just a backdrop for fundraising for some of the bigger aid groups like the Red Cross. And in fact, a lot of the money that was raised from people like us for Haiti relief and reconstruction after the earthquake is still sitting in funds in banks because these people have not been able to figure out how to properly spend the money. And people keep citing these statistics about millions of dollars in Haiti aid still in the bank, and I keep thinking, that sounds really bad. See, I waver on two sides on a lot of these things, and one of the things is I worry that it's really very hard to distribute this money. How do you distribute money in Haiti? You can't just throw it up in the air because there'll be a riot. If you give it to one person, you're not giving it to another person. If you give $500 to camp families, you don't know where they're going to spend that $500. So it's a very complicated thing. It's much more complicated than a mere reporter is able to unlock and untwist. And people always say to me, well, how would you fix Haiti? And I'm like, you know, I know it so well, and I can't fix it. That's why I'm not always in the process of attacking the Haitian government, which doesn't fix Haiti either, because I think the job is really very, very difficult. There are some simple things probably that could be done, but would they be tolerated by the outside world? I don't know. And we can talk about them when we have some questions here. So let's open it up to questions, okay? Anybody have anything they'd like to ask?
If you do have a question, just raise your hand and then I'll bring you the microphone.
So my name is Aline Schwei, and I'm a follower of Paul Farmer and the Partners in Health. And I was wondering, since you go there quite often, how is their new hospital that they built? I know it's solar-powered and supposed to bring lots of jobs and everything to the Haitians and help out their health care.
Well, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful facility. And it's very scary. You know, it's in its infancy. And so what happened was Partners in Health, which is Paul Farmer's group, they raised a huge amount of money after the earthquake. They stopped taking money after a certain point because they said, we can't deal with this much money. We can't distribute this much money. But Farmer had in his mind to build this hospital. When he first went to Haiti, he thought, like, let's just get very basic care. But then his vision for Haiti changed, and he thought, why should they just have very basic care? Why shouldn't they have some really good, modern, state-of-the-art care with Haitians learning how to do the medical jobs that need to be done? So he's done all sorts of things, but this hospital in Mirebalais is one of the incredible achievements. The thing is staffing it. The thing is making sure it operates at the level it can operate at, and that it doesn't become just a white elephant sitting empty in the Haitian countryside. It's not in town. It's out sort of on the way to all of the clinics, the countryside clinics of Paul Farmer's group. So that's the job that he has ahead of himself, and he wants to make sure. He doesn't want an embarrassment on his hands, of course. He wants it to be great, and he's working really hard to make it great. My brother happens to be a cardiologist whom I have gotten involved in Haiti since the earthquake, and he's trying to work on a cardiology unit within that hospital with Paul. So there are, and he's just one of the many mini projects that Paul has going in order to get the hospital working. I'm very optimistic about it because Paul Farmer has an incredible ability to make things happen. One of my favorite outsiders in Haiti. It's a short list, too. Anyone else? Yes.
Hi, my name is Sabrina. I am a student here. And a couple years ago, a professor that she was very, very passionate about traveling abroad, and she actually went to Haiti. She wasn't necessarily involved with the earthquake. She was more involved with teaching people how to teach English. But she noticed that while we put out a lot of images of people suffering from this earthquake and the devastation, and it's dirty, and she noticed that every single person there, every student, every kid, was dressed very cleanly. I mean, like anybody that you would see here. And I think, I was just wondering, do you think that reflects on a sense of pride that we almost refuse to see to try and do that, you know, get that fundraising, put out that image?
Yeah, I think that's a very apt way of thinking about it. But, of course, right after the earthquake, when most of the filming was done, everybody was, you know, in a state of debris and dust and freaked out and arms and legs broken, if not ripped off. So those were accurate images of a crisis. I mean, I am a journalist, let's be honest. You're not going to show happy school children going to school the day after an earthquake. And you wouldn't have found them. The schools were all shut. So, but as the thing proceeded, I think you'd see the images change. You'd see a lot of amputees. And you'd see, on the hopeful side, prostheses being used by the amputees of the earthquake. A friend of mine told a story about her tuberculosis clinic. It was very new. She was just establishing it right as the earthquake hit. And she had all these very sick patients, and some of them were HIV positive and untreated. And she was just beginning their treatment. And ABC TV, not to insult Mr. Hinckley, who was involved, the founder here, with ABC TV, but ABC TV came in, a news crew, and they said, oh, we want to shoot this. And my friend, who was the doctor in charge, she said, an American, she said, why? And they said, well, we need earthquake victims for our footage. And she said, these are not earthquake victims. These are tuberculosis sufferers. And they said, ah, we don't care. And they shot it. And that's, so you saw them on TV as earthquake people, but they weren't. So that's one of the problems that you have. They need the disaster footage. But I think as time went on, after the prostheses and the amputations, you started to see the pictures of school children, so life resuming, and happy children. That's another thing that outsiders like to show, is a white person surrounded by happy children. You go on Haiti images on Google, you'll see so many of these. I hate happy children now because I think they're just being used, and I don't want to see their happy, smiling faces anymore. Isn't that sad? I'm so hard-bitten. But it is absolutely true that even a week and a half after the earthquake, when the schools began to open, freshly scrubbed, adorable little children in their school uniforms that cost their families like, you know, an eighth of whatever income they can manage to scrounge together for the year, would be going to school walking over the rubble. So, yes, of course, it's a situation where you have to be hopeful because there's no other way to be. And Haitians are very, people say they're resilient. What that means is they're used to being destroyed, kept down, deprived. They lack entitlement and privilege of every kind, and yet they survive. And I don't think it's Haitian. I think it's human. I think resilience is human, and it shouldn't be attached as a label to one population. As a Jew, I think Jews were resilient in the Holocaust. Look, we survived. It's just mere survival is a sign of human resilience. And it's not specific to Haitians. And so I hate resilience, and I hate happy, smiling children. There, now you know what I'm like, the Scrooge of journalism. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Thank you for speaking to us. I'm Tim Chambliss. I teach here. My question is about, in the period of time since the January 12th earthquake, has there been signs of supporters of Baby Doc Duvalier, Papa Doc Duvalier, who have taken advantage of this disaster to perhaps try to come back to power or to at least see a significant rise in crime in Haiti that would be associated with the Duvaliers?
I think it's wrong to associate crime in Haiti today with the Duvaliers, but it's an interesting thing that you say. Because this was a really, really bad dictatorship. The father, worse than the son, but the son, not so great. You know, no freedom of speech, no freedom of the press, no freedom. A little bit like what you hear about Gaddafi in Libya, just complete power held by the dictator. And so I would say that the dictatorship is back in full force. I would even go so far as to say that the current president is basically a Duvalierist who has Duvalier relatives and the relatives of Duvalierists in his administration. He wants to turn back one of the singular achievements of the Aristide administration, which is he wants to bring back the army. And the army, it wasn't like Haiti was fighting against foreign forces. The army was used against the Haitian people. I think the dictatorship is coming back, but it's coming back as an elected democracy, supposedly. I was there for the elections in which Martelly was elected, and there was a lot of subterfuge in those elections, and only, I think, 30% of the population came out to vote, primarily because the party in which most people, to which most people assigned themselves, was forbidden from being in the election, the Lavalas party. So, and the OAS agreed and went along with the rise of Martelly as the president. And there was a lot of subterfuge. I mean, I don't do that kind of investigation, so I can't say with absolute certainty. But I saw a lot of signs of our support for this new pretty right-wing president. And there's a reason for that. He's good for business. He's good for outsiders in Haiti. And, you know, maybe there'll be some kind of trickle-down. It's kind of a Reagan-like situation there now. Anyone else?
I was wondering, since the whole cholera epidemic, after the, I know it was an NGO that was like an unsanitary water situation.
And it's called the United Nations.
UN, there we go. I was wondering, have you noticed any backlash from the Haitians towards the NGOs coming and trying to help?
There's always backlash. Papa Doc said, I love to quote Papa Doc because he was such a bad dictator, but he said some very true things. He said, all gratitude is cowardice. And so Haitians have a very complicated attitude toward outsiders. Because of that great revolution that started their history and because of a tradition of slavery and kind of hiding and not quite showing your true face, it's very complicated. So often, you know, outsiders don't understand why I gave her a rape kit and then she just turned around and walked away. She didn't say thanks. It's not like they feel you owe it to them. It's like they feel like a rape kit, what am I going to do with that, you know? Or a welcome kit or whatever. They're just like, and they don't want to show too much gratitude. But yet, they will be very polite. I mean, Haitians are among the most dignified and polite people I've ever met anywhere on the globe. And there was a lot of anger at the UN, partly because it wasn't just the UN coming in to be nice, it's MINUSTA. And MINUSTA is the UN's peacekeeping force on the ground in Haiti, which effectively is a foreign occupation force that's been there since President Aristide was overthrown for the second time. Haiti is so special. He was overthrown for the second time in 2004. So the Haitians don't love having an occupying force. And so they don't love MINUSTA in the first place. And then the cholera epidemic, which was associated with bad sanitary practices by these troops from, I think, Sri Lanka? I always get confused. Maybe Nepal. I think it's Nepal. So, they're really angry. But they're not marching on UN headquarters, you know. They're well-behaved, so we'll see what happens. I don't know. MINUSTA is always supposed to be leaving, but they never leave. Yes?
I was wondering if we could get a recap of those terms that you mentioned, like sympathy fatigue and those other terms.
Sympathy fatigue. Sympathy fatigue is when you've been in a grueling situation for a long time. It's not your home situation. You're not from the problem. And you just are sick of it. And you stop noticing people's pain. And you begin to think, oh, well, that's their country. That's how they live. That's okay. I don't, and you don't feel it anymore. Then what other ones did I say? I do like those expressions a lot. Charity anxiety. So I have this great situation at the beginning of my book where there's a guy, and I think I recognize him. I'm standing outside of an earthquake camp, and he's approaching me. And for some reason, I'm the only visible outsider there. That is to say, the only white person visible at that moment. And he's coming toward me, and I think I recognize him, and his face is full of rubble. Like rubble all over, earthquake rubble. But it's 2 years after the earthquake. And I'm thinking, hey, he's the guy in that picture from Time magazine. There was a cover photo of him on Time magazine. He's Rubble Man. Rubble Man still has the stuff on his face. So I'm thinking, oh, I'm about to be a victim of a scam. Because I was standing outside the hotel where all the journalists were coming for the second anniversary of the earthquake. So there he was. And I said to my guide, I said, what is this guy? He said, oh, I've seen him before. He's always hanging around to beg money from you guys. So I'm having charity anxiety. I mean, the guy, after all, he's done quite a job. He's kind of smart, right? He's figured out what's going to get pictures taken. He'll let you take his picture with him. And why not pay for his service? But on the other hand, it's a scam, and it's not nice, and it's taking advantage of my pity, and isn't it wrong, and why does he still look like that? And then after a while of thinking about him, so I had charity anxiety. After a while of thinking about him, I thought, well, maybe you can't get rid of that kind of rubble. Maybe it's like melded with his skin, maybe he's not scamming me. So that's the kind of thing that happens in Haiti all the time between outsiders and people inside. Is it a real problem? Should I give? Charity anxiety. A friend of mine just told me a great story, and maybe I'll leave you with this story. I don't know. This is an LA story, but I wished that I had had this story to use in my book. He's a guy, he runs a helicopter leasing company. So he's pretty well off. And every day he gets on the highway in LA, the freeway, excuse me, and there's a guy there on the corner who begs from the commuters. And the guy has a guitar and he has like six rocking horses. We don't know why. He's a little crazy. Everybody knows the guy. Everybody passes the guy. My friend is feeling a little flush. So instead of giving him the usual dollar, he has a $50 bill. He gives the guy a $50 bill. The guy takes the $50 bill and puts it in his pocket. And my friend is like, what? Hey! And he closes his window and drives on. The light has changed. And he thinks, wow, I gave the guy $50 and I don't get a thank you. And he didn't even know what he was anticipating. But he was anticipating the kind of gratitude that Papa Doc says is cowardice. He was anticipating the guy would look at it and go, wow, thank you, sir. And he didn't even recognize that he was anticipating some gratitude from someone in a big way until after he didn't get the gratitude. And we talked about it for a while, and I said, you know what? Maybe the guy saw that it was a $50 bill, and he didn't want to give you his big gratitude. Maybe he didn't like the idea of the big gratitude, or maybe he thought that you didn't know it was a $50 bill. You thought it was a dollar bill, and he wasn't going to give you the chance to take it back. So I think all of those things are embodied in the problem between outsiders and insiders in Haiti and in the giving and reconstruction process, that charity itself is called into question. And you have to really think hard about what the people on the ground need. You have to involve the people on the ground in your projects. Often the Haitian president himself was excluded from meetings of the outside NGOs in decisions they were about to make about what they were going to do in Haiti under the umbrella of their good-heartedness and relief effort. So include the people who are there. Make sure you know what they want before you decide what's the blueprint you're going to inflict on the population. I think that's the most important thing you can learn from this situation.
Yes, given the level of instability, governmental instability, and poverty and disease that you've indicated, could Haiti potentially be seen globally as a national security crisis in the Western Hemisphere to the United States. And I say this because a former national security advisor has described Haiti as being a national security threat.
Yeah, sure. I mean, any place where there's not the rule of law, like Mexico, is a national security threat to the United States, right? Any place nearby is especially scary. And there's a certain amount of narco-trafficking that goes through Haiti. I'm sure, you know, if terrorists wanted to live in Haiti, they could establish a beachhead there and they would have to live in Haiti. But, you know, I guess that would be conceivable. But to me, that just sounds like further excuses for further control, American control of Haiti, rather than anything serious. Because if you really want to look at the place where people would like to live and where they really can threaten the United States, that's Mexico, which has a huge narco-terror problem already.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all the time we have. Please join me in thanking our guest.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.